Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick O'Shaughnessy at History Chappie on social media. And today we are absolutely delighted to be joined by Ellen Alpstern, who is the author of Tsarina and The Tsarina's Daughter, which is forthcoming. Ellen, welcome to Versus History. We are absolutely delighted to have you as a guest today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me and for your interest in my work. It's me who's delighted. It's a pleasure.
Too kind. Let's get kicked off then. Please tell us a little bit about you, your background as a historian, and why you decided to venture into the world of historical writing. Over to you.
It depends how far back you'd like me to go.
As far as you want. You take it right
as far as I go. So I start right at the beginning. I was very blessed with a truly idyllic childhood. I grew up in the African highlands without any TV. My brothers were in boarding school. My father was a veterinary surgeon. I had plenty of pets, cats, dogs, geese, chicken, a stroppy polo pony, a grumpy wounded serval cat, and at times even a baby crocodile. And lots of those pets I actually just dressed up and told them stories to keep myself entertained. Actually, the wish to write, I think, came, as for most writers, through all the reading I did. Later, when we moved back to Europe, every week I got literally a washing basket full of books from the library and just read, dreaming equally, big dreams, because I lived always in these tiny villages that had more cattle than human inhabitants, because my father, of course, as I said, is a vet, so that was his field of work. And I'd save my pocket money to buy Vogue, which is not literally, but you know, it was equally a door into a very different world I actually could never hope to belong to. So writing for me was a way of dreaming, an escapism, if you so wish. I was lucky and published a first piece when I was 17 in my country's biggest newspaper. But then I started studying and I was always busy with something else. And, you know, all my energies were dispersed until my Parisian Grande École, which is called Sciences Po, a school that trains politicians and all the French presidents like Mitterrand, Chirac, have been there. Emmanuel Macron was actually 2 years beneath me, but I was already too young for him, even so. Sorry, naughty comment. And so this Grande École staged a writing competition, and which I won, to my surprise, with a short story called Meeting Mr. Gandhi. Thank you. It was, you see, I mean, you're a teacher, how important it is to have these competitions and to foster early interest and talent, because on the back of winning this little short story competition that really, apart from the 3,000 students that were at the school, fostered no interest whatsoever, I put that bang smack on top of my querying letter with my agency when I felt ready to really write. When I moved to London, I started my first job. And I think I just had the wrong attitude, Patrick. I really struggled with the corporate life, the office politics. I wanted more freedom. I earned very little money. My fiancé was not with me already. So every evening I sat down and I wrote for real. I really channeled all these energies and I got serious and I pelted agencies, publishers with postcards, with phone calls, with letters. I simply pitched up in their office, I'm not leaving before we don't discuss my book. And finally,
of course.
I mean, I think that's how you have to do it. Persistence pays. And finally that worked out. It wasn't really the Tsarina project, which we will speak about later, but another book, which did never quite work out. But then the publisher said, or the agent said, don't you have anything else? And then I said, yeah, actually I do.
Well, we're glad you did. And I think they call it the cathartic effect, the process of writing and self-soothing simultaneously. So we're really glad you've seen it through. And your first book, Tsarina, was out in hardback last year, and the paperback is out this summer. And your second book, The Tsarina's Daughter, is published in hardback this July. So what are these two books all about, Ellen? Without giving too much away, obviously.
Both Tsarina and the Tsarina's daughter are part of the Tsarina series, which is a planned quartet of novels, so four books. And these books, for the first time ever in Western literature, cover the unique century of female reign in Russia. Because for almost 100 years, Russia, this absolute behemoth, the world's largest and wealthiest realm, was governed by women. And in the 18th century, so their reign flew into the face of this very brutal male-dominated society. So that is the background to Tsarina, the Tsarina's daughter, which is really an epic cloaked in ice and snow. Tsarina is the world's ultimate Cinderella story. She rises from illiterate serf to the first ruling empress of Russia ever. And also Russia itself morphs from a backward nation to the beginnings of the modern superpower we know today. And Russia is a mystery for us again. We have a Tsar again in Russia. So reading these books, Tsarina, the Tsarina's daughter, will help you understand Russia better. Funny enough, the Tsarina's daughter then lives her mother's story to the inverse, because she falls from unimaginable riches to desperate rags and rises from those rags to Romanov. So it's a real roller coaster.
Thank you, Ellen. Okay, a question that always really interests our listeners who are budding historians and writers themselves. How did you go about researching both of these books? And why do you think this history is so significant and so important right now, today?
In hindsight, Patrick, you might know that yourself. Naivety protects quite often. And if I had known the amount of research that was necessary to really evoke the detail that you find in both books, because that's what every reviewer say, that both Tsarina and Tsarina's daughter, it's you read like watching a film. You're walking through that scenario together with my hitherto hidden historical heroine. So I did research for a year before I dared to write the first sentence. But you know, that happens actually very quickly, because I started reading, obviously, the Russian classics, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Gogol. Then I read Russian fairy tales, because that is so important to understand the imaginary of a people. How in the end of each fairy tale, the storyteller wipes his beard with honey. So obviously he wants to be rewarded. That no fairy or spirit is ever good in the Russian mythology. They're always ill-willing. What does that tell you about a people's relationship to their country, their very harsh nature and climate? I also watched films like Battleship Potemkin, or watching this Dogma movie, The Ark. And of course, lots of sources from the original time. There's an invaluable travel diary by a German merchant who visited the father of Peter the Great, where he writes, oh my God, these people are not better than animals. So I read all that. And then even while writing, I always had three, four books open marked with post-its. I think that's the prerogative. If you want to write proper historical fiction, it's a tricky beast, because you don't want the cold, hard retelling of history, just the facts. You know, for that, you don't need a novelist. Or you don't want a soppy, romanticized version either. You want that perfect blend of entertainment and instruction. And I think everybody who loves historical fiction and who writes historical fiction had that epiphany of reading that one, two, three novels who did that so masterfully. For me, I think that was Désirée by Anne-Marie Selinko, which is still, after Gone with the Wind, the world's second best-selling historical novel. Certainly I, Claudius by Robert von Ranke Graves. Just amazing. Sinoé the Egyptian. I mean, these are all older historical novels, but unforgettable. If I manage to write like that, I'm happy.
Absolutely. You've touched on something that the previous female novelists we've interviewed have said about sort of striding that balance between sort of telling the story, but also integrating historical facts as well. We talked to Jennifer Anton, who wrote The Under the Light of the Italian Moon, and Miranda Mallins, who wrote about Oliver Cromwell and her book The Puritan Princess. I'm really pleased you picked up on that for our listeners. So thank you, Ellen. Okay, then for context, We have to root this in chronology before we go further. Could you outline how Russia was ruled prior to the two revolutions in 1917, which ultimately resulted in the communist dictatorship that lasted right up to December the 25th, 1991? Who were the Tsars and how did this dynasty operate?
That's a fascinating question, because while everybody sort of knows their Tudors and perhaps their Bourbons, perhaps the Habsburgs, if you're lucky, the Romanovs are often limited to the last tragic Tsars and indeed Catherine the Great, who was no Romanov at all. The Romanovs ruled Russia for 300 years as one of the Tsarist dynasties before you had the Rurik Tsars, one of which was Ivan the Terrible, or Ivan the Terrible as the most famous. And that was followed by the Time of Troubles, where Russia suffered a Cossack occupation. And then in 1613, actually the first Romanov Tsar was voted into office. So in 1913, the Romanovs celebrated their 300-year reign over Russia. And if you ever say that you have an omnipotent ruler, I think nobody was ever as omnipotent as the Tsars. As I say, Russia was the richest realm in the world. It was a sixth of a globe, just this huge country that was completely, was the private treasure chest of this one family. Life was unimaginable. There were palaces of 500-600 rooms dotted all over the country. And of course, nothing was so superfluous and at the same time so expendable as human life. Even after the abolition of serfdom, a Tsar could just always take anything. Whatever belonged to any Russian, first and foremost, belongs to the Tsar. So I don't think there was ever again, or perhaps even before, a kind of government or rulership that was as all-encompassing and omnipotent as the Tsarist one. And of course, in our days, in our blessed days of democracy, where we have the freedom and privilege of vote, we are utterly fascinated by that. And then that you actually have women governing, ruling, running the country within this obviously very brutal, ruthless, dominating system makes it double interesting.
It absolutely does. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, into the content then. So your first book, Tsarina, is the story of Peter the Great's wife and outlines how Marta started out as a serf or a peasant and ended up as Tsarina, named Catherine, the ruler of Russia. This is something of an outlandish tale of rags to riches, is it not? What made this transformation possible? Was it simply a case of luck, or was it due more to her resolve, intellect and fortitude, or perhaps some different causal factors entirely? What made this transformation possible and happen, in your view?
Marta, who, as you say, was born as an illiterate serf in the Baltics, was very often at the right time at the right place, and then certainly took the right decision. She was equally living in a time of great turmoil that often offers great choices. We remember that Napoleon, in a speech to his soldiers, said, you know what, each of you has got a field marshal's uniform in your backpack, which meant, you know, you do the right thing and you can rise very hard. It was like a first meritocracy. And if you actually look at Peter the Great's circle of chosen friends, being of low birth was almost a prerogative to be admitted to that circle of friends. None of his very close advisors actually was a high Russian noble. So we're almost looking at the theory of the economist Schumpeter, who speaks of creative destruction, that out of great crisis and catastrophe actually arises a new creation. Yes, Marta was at the right place at the right time. She met Peter the Great as a prisoner of war without wanting to give too much away. And she just had amazing character and stamina and something else which we probably nowadays would qualify as sex appeal, because if you look at her portraits, you know, she's not Keira Knightley, but a contemporary observer says she's not beautiful, but she's as warm as an animal. And somebody you certainly meet through the novel Tsarina as well is her husband, Peter the Great. And you see him with very, very different eyes and how he became the man he is and how deftly she handles him. She was never afraid of him. If he didn't get up in time in the morning for a meeting after nights of debauchery, she would just take a bucket of water and pour it straight over him and say, "Get up, old man." So nobody else ever, nobody else ever dared that. Or when he had an epileptic fit, because ever since a very traumatic incident at the age of 8, when basically his whole family was slaughtered in front of his eyes, and his mother was given the choice whom should be killed, his uncle or her son, and she chose her brother to die over Peter, and he had to watch his uncle being hacked to pieces. So ever since he suffered seizures, she was the only one who would just grab his head and place it in her cleavage and just hold him until he calmed down. And we're speaking about a man who stands 7 feet high in his boots. And she's a little woman, buxom. So it's just, she's just so strong and so witty and so earthy. She's a fantastic creature. She's a very modern woman, as is Tsarina's daughter again, in front of this beguiling historical background.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you for that. Okay, moving on to your second book then, The Tsarina's Daughter. That's the story of Elizabeth, the Russian empress, who, though born as a princess, free to pursue her passions, ends up having everything snatched away from her. When her mother dies, she becomes penniless and powerless, living her mother's story in reverse, from riches to rags. Could you tell us more about that? What cruel twists of fate made this dramatic decline in fortune possible?
But Tsarina's Daughter indeed lives her mother's story to the inverse. And it's again the first novel in Western literature about Empress Elizabeth ever, which I find an incredible stroke of luck. I'm living an historian's dream here, or an historian's novelist's dream. These ladies are really my Tutankhamun who were hiding in plain sight. It is true that when Elizabeth is born, she was hailed Europe's or the world's most lovely princess. Peter the Great was hoping to marry her off to Louis XV. She should rule in Versailles. Those were her dreams for her. And of course, then when he suddenly died and then her mother took over the throne, the situation changed. Her mother was the second wife of Peter the Great, Tsarina, as we know, a former washermaid, and the Bourbons would just never dream of, you know, their king marrying the daughter of a serf and a washermaid. I mean, utterly preposterous, the idea. And then when the mother died, all of a sudden, her fortune really changed, and masks fall and friends turn foes. And it's equally a picture of the choices she's given. She's basically given the choice of a second-rate match or retiring to a convent, and she wants to do neither. So again, a very modern woman, she chooses to go her own path, even though that's very stony. And she has to survive more than a decade of latent terrorism, where every day, every morning, she's never sure if she will actually see the sun set again, or will she see the sun set again in liberty, at least. But next to all this, you're really sitting at the edge of your seat with Elizabeth, you're thinking what's happening, how she will survive, and her inner journey from this spoiled, pampered, protected princess of the House of Romanov to this staunch and savvy survivor is what fascinated me when I wrote about it. But it's equally, again, a wonderful, very unexpected love story, a passion who in the end gives her the strength to become who she is. And when she claims what is hers, it comes at a terrible price. But, you know, ruling Russia is not for wimps, so she has to go forward.
Indeed. Okay, then. Those who took everything from Elizabeth didn't know that she would fight to get everything that she had lost back again. Though isolated and impoverished and a woman in a man's Russia, Elizabeth certainly didn't give up. And so this is a story of fighting against the odds, I suppose. Please tell us more about that fortitude, that guile, that stoic nature to whet our appetite for the book.
Absolutely. I think the one thing that I found very hard when I did my research was sort of this constant rampant maltreatment of women. And that is equally displayed in the marriages she witnesses around her. So obviously her cousins, it was a first for Romanov princesses to get married off, because before actually a Tsar's daughter or sister was not to be married. They lived a sheer monastic existence hidden away in the Kremlin, in quarters that were uniquely for women, where no man was to visit, so almost like a harem. It was a heritage from the Cossack occupation. And Peter the Great broke with that tradition. And he said, no, no, my nieces, daughters, sisters are marriage material. And so he married off his nieces. He married off Elizabeth's elder sister. And she just witnessed these marriages crumble. And, you know, all these German dukes who are wife beaters, who have gambling debts, who drink. And she just says for herself, I do not want this for myself. So this process of getting aware that she actually has a choice and she can make this choice is quite fantastic. And the multitude of characters she encounters and that make up her world, you know, when I wrote it, I almost felt like weaving a beautiful tapestry to cover a wall in the Winter Palace. It's really, it's a story put together on a loom with 1,000 threads. And it's so colorful and so detailed, and it will draw you right in, and it will leave you with the greatest respects for the Tsarina's daughter.
Certainly does. Thank you very much indeed. So in that vein then, Ellen, are there any final words from you to encourage us to buy either or perhaps even both of the books? Let's pretend you're not speaking to me, you're speaking to someone maybe getting off the train at Waterloo, Victoria, or Penn Station in NYC, and they want to buy a book for the return leg, the journey home. Why should they buy yours out of all the thousands that are there? A tough question. An author's hate asking it, answering it, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. Why should they buy this book or books?
Wherever you are in the world, especially after the 1.5 years more than 1 year that the world has suffered in 2020 and 2021. Both Tsarina and the Tsarina's daughters are ultimate Cinderella stories and the perfect escapism. It will allow you to dream and to see that dreams can come true. It is historical fiction, but my heroines are utterly modern women who fight to overcome a fate raging against them, and they vanquish crisis, catastrophe, and live amazing love stories. So what more is there to say?
Yeah, what more is there to say, and what better way to sell it? Okay, the final thing from you then, Ellen, before we say goodbye. These books, who are they published by and where can we get them? Because you've got two out. So which ones are out now, in which format, and where can we purchase them?
In the UK, both Tsarina and the Tsarina's Daughter are out. Tsarina in paperback and hardback. Tsarina's Daughter in hardback since the 8th of July. In the US and Canada, Tsarina is out since last autumn. For the Tsarina's Daughter, you'll have to wait until March 2022. But I trust, thanks to, you know, global online business, you should be able to procure the book if you're so interested. But I thank you in advance for all your interest, and I'm looking forward to hear what you think about it.
Well, it's a fantastic set of publications, and to our North American friends, it's definitely worth waiting for if you can't get an Amazon.co.uk delivery over across the Atlantic, or perhaps not even Amazon, perhaps somewhere else, who knows. Anyway, Ella, it's been an absolute delight having you join us. Is there anything that you wanted to mention, but that my limited, parochial, myopic, short-sighted questions didn't give you the scope to talk about? Or have you covered everything that you'd like to cover?
Your questions were absolutely spot on, and I just want to say what a privilege it is to work on these ladies, and I'm utterly obsessed with them. I can talk endlessly about them, so please call back, Patrick. Call back soon.
anytime. And a lot of our listeners like to get in touch with authors to discuss. Is there any way? Are you on Twitter, Instagram, or any of the social media platforms?
Yes, I have my accounts on LinkedIn and Twitter, Instagram, if you search Ellen Alpston author, equally on Facebook, and I'd be delighted if you follow me. It's all about literary life and the very varied daily chores of an author. Last night, for instance, I was at an awards ceremony in central London, and today I was pounding the pavement with a bag of proofs, visiting bookstores and making sure that my books are well positioned.
Fantastic. Got to put the work in. Thank you so much for joining us on Versus History, Ellen. We're absolutely delighted to have had you as a guest. We're delighted to be shining the historical spotlight on these underrepresented figures that you've spoken about so eloquently today. And listeners, we'll be running a couple of competitions on our social media platforms. So if you're looking to win a copy, we might be giving one or two away from our own pocket. So folks, head over to versushistory.com or the Versus History platforms for that. But Ellen, anyway, thank you so much for joining us and giving us 30 to 40 minutes of your day. We're really, really grateful. Come back anytime, please.
Well, I thank you for the invitation and lots of love to all your listeners all over the world. Well done you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.